Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. KGAB AM 650 in the Town Square Network serving the Intermountain West, and KFEZ Colorado Springs and WebTalkRadio.net. I'm delighted today to bring you Ed Klein, author of the number one New York Times bestseller, The Amateur, about our illustrious president, Barack Hussein Obama. And Ed has done extensive research. His background is really impressive. He attended Colgate University, got a master's degree from the Columbia University School of Journalism. As a as somebody who studied journalism myself in college, I can tell you that there is no more prestigious journalism school. He's a former foreign editor of Newsweek. He was the editor-in-chief of the New York Times Magazine. He's had a number of New York Times bestsellers, and his book, The Amateur, which everybody is talking about and which we're going to talk about today, has been a number one New York Times bestseller for 6 weeks, and it's been on the New York Times bestseller list for 15 weeks, the last few in the number two position. Maybe after this show, I can exhort you folks to go out and read this, because you need to for your children's children, and we'll make it number one again. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Reed, and thank you for those very kind words.
Well, all well-deserved, and I didn't even get into half of your resume. So I want to ask you, we're going to cover a number of subjects today, from Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton to Valerie Jarrett, international affairs, the national debt, and we're going to finish up with a discussion between you and I as to whether this is intentional or he's just a boob. So I want to get started here, number one, with the Bill Clinton gave an amazing speech, unfortunately, at the Democratic National Convention. Now, if you taper that back to all the things in your book, the things that he has said behind the scenes about Barack Obama, in fact, you got the name of the book from one of his comments, The Amateur, where is this guy coming from? What prompted him to get up there and give such a blockbuster delivery of somebody he obviously dislikes and disrespects?
Well, you know, Bill said many things to his wife, Hillary, and that I quote in my book. One of them is, there's no such thing as loyalty in politics. But the obverse of that, or the other side of that, is there's no such thing as being too ashamed or doing anything that is shameful. You can get away with anything in politics, according to Bill Clinton. Clintons and the Obamas are the Hatfields and McCoys of the Democratic Party. They are in a feud and have been in a feud since the Obamas accused Clinton of being a racist in 2008, and the Clintons accused the Obamas campaign of using shameful, dirty tactics. I mean, they just don't like each other. Bill Clinton has said numerous times that he never hears from this president. He doesn't have a relationship with this president. He doesn't respect this president. And here we have him standing up at the Democratic National Convention and giving a blockbuster speech, maybe one of the greatest speeches of his career, in favor of Barack Obama. So the question obviously is why? And I think you have to understand that as far as Clinton is concerned, he was there for himself, number one, more than he was for Obama, and he succeeded. After he was finished speaking, I think a lot of people said to themselves, gee, I wish he were running for president, and that's exactly what he wanted. He wanted to burnish the Clinton brand, because in his view, 2012 is not the decisive election. 2016 is the decisive election. That's the election in which he hopes, if his health holds out and Hillary's health holds out, she will run for president. And this was the first marker in that long road to the presidency, this speech. And so I think it was given to show that the Clintons were the leaders of the party. And in fact, I think it worked because, by comparison, Barack Obama's speech looked very lame.
Well, not only that, there were some interesting body language things that happened when they hugged. And, you know, I mean, there was a lot of things that lead to that. Let me ask you a question, though. If he wants Hillary to be president in 2016,
mm-hmm.
and Barack Obama, whether he's an amateur or whether he's a pro and really smart, does what he is thought he might do in his second term, in which case this country will be twice as worse off as it is now, why would Clinton think that that would help the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton be elected as opposed to a Republican?
Well, don't forget, you know, Bill Clinton has been out of office for 12 years. He has not had the opportunity to address a nationwide audience of tens of millions of people in prime time in 12 years. This was a great opportunity for him to do what he loves best, which is, of course, to promote himself and the Clinton brand. He also has to show to the Democratic Party and the left wing of the Democratic Party, which now controls the Democratic Party, that the Clintons are in tune with them, that the Clintons, who are known to be more centrist and less far to the left, are actually in sync with the party. And I think that was another big move of his in the speech, was to show that he has, in fact, moved back to the left wing of the party. And
right, and I agree with you. I think
establishes his and Hillary's bona fides with that segment of the party, which now virtually runs the party.
Yeah, it's a progressive party. It's no longer the Democratic Party, for sure. Now, let me ask a question. You know, he tried to get Hillary to run. I read that whole section of your book with avid interest. And he had this quote in there, which really, it's kind of like what he had said prior to this speech about Barack Obama. Quote, "The economy is a mess. It's dead flat. America has lost its triple A rating. You know better than Obama does," speaking to Hillary and trying to get her to run for 2012. In your opinion, why didn't Hillary run in 2012? I think she probably could have won the nomination.
At the time he was speaking to her in August of 2011, I think there was no doubt that she could have taken Obama. Hillary, I believe, and this is based on some of my reporting inside the Clinton camp after the book came out, Hillary had to make a decision. If she ran with Obama as the vice president on his ticket, and he won, and then she ran in 2016 as president, she would be in the position of having to defend the Obama administration's policies and performance over the past 8 years. Same thing happened, as you noted, Hubert Humphrey when he ran for president after he was vice president with Lyndon Johnson. So she looked at that and said, you know, she does not believe in what Obama believes in terms of his economic policies and even some of his foreign policy. If, on the other hand, she ran with him and he lost, then she would be smeared as a loser. And so in her view, it was a lose-lose proposition. There was no reason for her to run, and many reasons for her not to run with him.
So the bottom line, let's boil it all down to its essence, is that the egos of the Clintons and their desperate wish to get in the White House again was actually superior in their minds than the interests of the country.
Oh, without any doubt.
Yep.
But I think there are very few politicians who are active today who don't put their own personal ambitions ahead of the country's. I mean, there may be some, but there certainly aren't many.
Yes, well, that happens to be one of the problems, which I've talked to my audience about for years, but that is yet another tale. I want to get something out of the way here before we get into some of these other really interesting subjects, and that is, you know, you have written a number of best-selling books. In fact, you wrote a book on Hillary Clinton. I mean, I consider you an expert on her for sure. You've written a book on other folks. I think think all of them have been New York Times bestsellers. Correct me if I'm
wrong.
That's
right. They all have been on the list, thank God.
And, you know, the left loves to throw scat at you. I mean, I get a kick out of some of the articles. They never attack your facts. They always give some obtuse, well, he didn't really get this from this interview. He got it from so-and-so. And, you know, others say, well, that's not really what I said. I mean, there's no denial. There's no offsetting fact or circumstance. There's all these pot shot distracting little bullets that they send at you. I want to give you a minute to maybe talk about a couple of those and tell me how you handle them.
Well, I'll give you a very up-to-date example of that. In the current issue of Time magazine, there's an article about conservative books, and it says about me there that Klein wrote The Amateur with the same dull pencil he uses to ghostwrite the Walter Scott column in Parade magazine. Now, I did write that column at one point. I haven't written that column in years, and yet they're saying, you know, that they're taking a shot at me for that. But more to the point, more importantly, the writer in Time magazine says that The Amateur is a brisk mixture of previously reported stories and unverifiable anecdotes. Well, my book is based on nearly 200 interviews, many of them on the record, and it's full of newsworthy reporting, including a three-hour tape-recorded first-ever interview with the Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
Yeah, which we're going to be getting into later in this interview. It's fascinating.
An on-the-record interview with prominent African-American businessmen and political figures who, for the first time, expressed their disillusionment with President Obama. The first full-length critical examination of Valerie Jarrett's power inside the White House.
Scary.
A lengthy analysis based on more than a dozen on-the-record interviews of President Obama's problems with the Jewish American community, an exclusive reporting on the collapse of the relationship between Oprah Winfrey and President and Mrs. Obama, exclusive reporting based on interviews with several members of the Kennedy family, of Carolyn Kennedy's fruitless efforts to meet with and influence Barack Obama, and on and on. So they are constantly... It is sad because you'd think that they would, you know, find some basis for this criticism, and they make things up. It's absolutely untrue allegations. Most of them, what they call, you know, personal ones, that, you know, I make things up, I lie, I do it. I've been a journalist for 50 years. I've interviewed everybody from Anwar Sadat to Ronald Reagan. And believe me, everything is double and triple checked. Most of my books, by the way, have been excerpted and run in Vanity Fair magazine, where I'm a contributing editor. And Vanity Fair magazine has the most rigorous fact-checking department you can imagine. It sometimes takes them 2 or 3 weeks to fact-check every single word that goes in the magazine. And I've had no problems getting... most of my books excerpted in that magazine through the fact-checking process. So
yeah, Ed, I
no longer take these criticisms very seriously because they're not based on anything.
No,
that's
exactly what they are. They're venom without fact, and they're obvious attempts at distraction. Having been in the hot seat myself on several occasions, number one, I empathize. Number two, I agree completely with your assessment and your bona fides. So let's get to the next question because I think it's kind of interesting. You know, you call basically what you call Obama is, he's an adrift radical. You know, he's in over his head. He's drowning in incompetence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yet, and we're going to be coming more into this at the end of the show, you know, he's managed to get $5 trillion of borrowing done. He's managed to do it without passing a budget. He's managed to pass Obamacare, which even Hillary Clinton couldn't do. He's managed to almost single-handedly turn upside down the foreign policy of the United States. He's managed to weaken us in the areas of defense and elsewhere in terms of real defense status, Russia, as compared to Russia, China, you know, anybody else in the world. So your feelings are, based on what I would call his accomplishments, based on what he wants to get done, you think are pretty much, shall we say, just he doesn't know what he's doing. Is that accurate?
Well, I would say that he is a toxic combination of a far left-wing ideologue and a amateur when it comes to governance. He's certainly not an amateur as a campaigner. He's a good campaigner. And
a manipulator.
He's a good entertainer. He's a good, you know, performer. He can give good speeches, although I don't think he's doing as well as he used to do. He looks good. He's thin. He's in shape. He dresses nicely. He's got nice neckties and so forth. However, when it comes to the actual manipulation of the levers of power in Washington, he is an amateur in the sense that he doesn't know how to do it. So his Obamacare, for instance, it was not his bill. He outsourced that to Nancy Pelosi and the
and Max Baucus.
And Max Baucus and the majority in the House of Representatives that he had and the majority he then had in his first 2 years in the Senate. So that he really that bill and the bill, the other bills that he was interested in were not written in the White House. They were written.
No, I understand that. And, you know, while we're on health care, there was a great part of your book where you interviewed his former doctor, okay? Mm-hmm. And bottom line of that interview is the doctor who, in reading your book, I mean, I don't know the doctor from Adam. He's
Dr.
kind of
David Scheinert.
Yeah, he's a left-wing guy.
Very left-wing.
He wants a single-payer system.
Right.
But what he said about the system that Obama allowed to be put in place is what really caught my attention. That is, it was doomed to be hugely expensive and doomed to fail.
That's right.
So that brings me back to the same question. You know, Obama, I think we'll both agree, is not an unintelligent guy. I think that there's enough people around him, whatever their ideological bent, they can do the math. So wouldn't you say that allowing the Senate, allowing these other groups, the Apollo Foundation in terms of the stimulus, to develop these bills, which are not going to work, which are going to be hugely expensive and add to the debt, if he had a sinister purpose, if it was on purpose, wouldn't that kind of tie in? I mean, wouldn't it be kind of brilliant allowing the Senate to make a mistake?
Well, this has to, you know, here's where you and I may disagree. This, your point of view assumes that actually he is a kind of almost Manchurian candidate, sinister guy who is in fact out to destroy the United States. I take a different view. I see him as a far left-wing ideologue who wants to transform the United States, not destroy it, which it will destroy the United States, mind you. That's not his goal. His goal is to transform it into what, obviously, into an entitlement state, socialist entitlement state like those in Europe.
And a lesser sovereign state at the,
yes.
We'll call it the table of nations of the planet.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And
okay.
And you and I would agree that will ultimately destroy the United States as we know it. I think that's true. But that he's actually consciously setting out to destroy the country. I think he believes in his own point of view to the exclusion of everybody else's, because he thinks he's the smartest person in the room, that he knows best, that he's righteous, and that he's on the side of good and everybody else is on the side of evil, and that he should pursue his policies because they're the good, righteous policies, and whereas in fact they're not. They're actually policies that are going to work against the continued health of this country, both domestically and in foreign affairs.
And particularly the middle class.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no question that four more years of Obama, it's hard to imagine that this country will be recognizable after if we have him for four more years.
We agree. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a little bit about his M.O., you know, how secretive the guy really is despite his wide smile and waves to the masses of crowds, and who he kind of relies on for advice, and what their ideologies are, what might drive them. So right now we're going to take a hard break, then we're going to be back with Ed Klein, author of The Amateur, number one best-selling New York Times expose of Obama. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the right side, KGAB AM 650, Cheyenne, the Town Square Network serving the Intermountain West, and KFEZ, Colorado Springs. Howdy, Colorado Springs, and webtalkradio.net.
It is the spring of 1855. America is on the cusp of her great westward expansion and on the threshold of becoming a world power. The promise of land, freedom, self-determination, and economic opportunity is known worldwide, drawing immigrants from every continent, eager to exchange lives of drudgery and emptiness for the hope and romance of a country embarked on the course of greatness. This is the setting of the 16-book Threads West series, Reed Lance Rosenthal's epic American saga of the West, in which a few brave men and women venture out to love and struggle in the beautifully vibrant but unforgiving landscape of the West, Threads West. And when you finish that multi-award-winning number one best-selling novel, you can also get the number one best-selling Maps of Fate, the second book in the saga, just released this spring. Find them on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and in all major bookstores. Go to ThreadsWestSeries.com. That's ThreadsWestSeries.com.
We're back on the air with Ed Klein, author of the number one New York Times bestseller, The Amateur, and we're discussing Barack Obama, what kind of drives him, and we're going to talk right now, amongst many other subjects upcoming in the interview, about who he relies on for advice and how secretive this guy really is. I mean, in reading your book and kind of watching behind the scenes, Ed, I would say this guy is as extroverted and gregarious as he can be in front of a crowd. This is really kind of a loner, introvert, morose personality.
That's true. What you see is not what you get. What you see is a guy who is turned on by the crowds and is a very effective performer, as I've said before. What everyone else sees who works in the White House or comes from the Congress to the White House for meetings is a very different character. They see, and I've written about this in The Amateur, they see a fellow who holds meetings in which he holds forth, tells the people in the room what's best for them and the country, doesn't listen to countervailing or contradictory points of view, and in fact, if somebody does contradict him, he gives them what has now been now called the death stare. He is not someone who is open to other ideas, and he relies, to get to your point, on a very small group of inner colleagues and people who think exactly the way he does. And the two most important people in the White House after him are, in fact, his wife, Michelle Obama, and her very best friend, Valerie Jarrett, who hired Michelle years ago in Chicago, and functions as a senior political advisor to both the president and the first lady.
With a 24/7 full service Secret Service detail to boot.
Yes, indeed. You know, Harry Hopkins was a very good friend of Eleanor Roosevelt's back in the 1930s. He also ran the New Deal for Franklin Roosevelt. And at one point, he lived in the White House. And not since Harry Hopkins, but Harry Hopkins had a curriculum vitae. He had a biography that gave him, there was a real reason for his position of power. I mean, he had done so many things before the White House. Valerie Jarrett is the first person since Harry Hopkins, we're talking about 70 years ago, who is influencing both the First Lady and the President. So she, for instance, at the end of the day, She will go upstairs to the family quarters and have dinner with the president, his wife, and their two daughters. No one else in the White House has that privilege. She goes on vacations with the Obamas to Martha's Vineyard. She travels with them to foreign countries. And, in fact, she chooses whom they are going to see in, when they go to those countries and what cities they go to. And finally, she can choose to attend any meeting she wants in the White House, whether it's national security, and she has absolutely no background in foreign affairs, or domestic policies, and she has no economic background. And she's the last person to leave the Oval Office after a meeting. And when people leave, they look back over their shoulder and they see her whispering into the ear of the President of the United States. And they don't have the slightest idea what she's saying, what she's telling him about what others have said, if she is poor-mouthing them and their positions.
Well, you know, given the state of the country, I think we can guess as to what those whispers might be. You know, tell the audience a little bit about Valerie Jarrett's background. I've gone over that from time to time in the last 2 years of broadcasting, but I think folks will find it very interesting as to what the general makeup is of the lips that are closest to the ear of the man who is responsible for our destiny.
Well, Jarrett comes from a distinguished African-American family, very, very light-skinned, and I would not normally bring that up except that within the African-American community, that's often an important fact. She, her father was a physician and practiced in Iran for many years, and Valerie grew up in Iran and learned to speak Farsi, the language of Iran. She is very friendly to this day with a number of Jordanian figures, including the president of the King of Jordan, and she is quite pro-Palestinian. In Chicago, where her parents finally settled, her mother was also a very prominent figure in Chicago. She became what the newspapers in Chicago called the black face of the Daley administration. Bill Daley was, not Bill Daley, sorry, Mayor Daley was the mayor, the Democratic machine mayor of Chicago, and Valerie was his deputy chief of staff. And she was there to do the outreach to the African American community, even though she herself had very little connection to the African American community because of her stature as being so wealthy and privileged. She had gone to Stanford University and then Michigan Law School. She had very little connection to the street African Americans. Back in the 80s, she hired Michelle Obama to work for her and gave her her first job. And it was Valerie Jarrett who took the Obamas, who were not well connected at all in Chicago, and introduced them to the power centers in Chicago. African American political leaders, African American business leaders.
So in a way, they kind of owe their ascendancy to her.
Completely. Completely.
And to her contact.
I mean, she who introduced him to David Axelrod, to Jewish American donors, to political figures who were prominent. And she hitched her wagon to the Obamas, and they have been ever grateful since then. She helped them helped Obama win the U.S. Senate seat, and then she was on the campaign in 2008. He brought her to the White House with him and has said, these are not his exact words, but almost his exact words, that he said, I don't make any decision without first checking with Valerie. I run everything by her. She's, somebody I trust completely. Michelle Obama has said the same thing. This is
a Bengali-like
figure in the midst of the White House, and she's very, very left-wing.
And to kind of play on that, going back even further into her history, her father was good friends with Frank Marshall, right?
I don't know if that's the case. It could be.
Yeah, I've done the research on it, and actually, the young Obama met that quite noted communist, I mean, kind of the communist spokesperson of his day, through knowing Valerie Jarrett and Valerie Jarrett's association through her father with that same person. So, you know, this is the influence from early on, and in my opinion anyway, Ed, I think, you know, at least partially shaped her along with many other factors in her extreme leftist views, which I think your book portrays really well. And for people need to think about, when you read this book, and I really, really, really tell you, you need to read it. Not only that, you need to get people in the swing states to read it, folks. Ohio, Virginia, Florida. You got family there? You got friends there? You got friends of friends there? Buy them a book. It's like a campaign contribution. Let them read this book. You know, try and get their mental light bulbs to blink. Ed, you know, Michelle Obama. Now, she sat in the pews along with Barack Baby of Reverend Wright for 20 years. I mean,
right.
You know, Clinton saying he didn't inhale and Barack saying he didn't hear the sermons is like one and the same in my world. But the bottom line is, what drives Michelle Obama? She's like this incredible push in your book, and I think you can see it when she interacts with crowds or interacts with Obama on camera. She's like the push behind the success. What drives her, in your opinion?
I did a good deal of research on that, on this subject for my book, The Amateur. What I discovered is that, you know, Michelle likes to say that she hates politics. She has no interest in politics, that she has always stayed away from politics. Well, the fact is quite the opposite. Michelle Obama's father, who had muscular MS, was a precinct captain in the daily political machine. A precinct captain is the person who is in the neighborhood and whose job it is to turn out the vote at every election for the Democratic machine. And in return, the precinct captain gets something. And in the case of Michelle Obama's father, he became a pump operator in the water department. So he had this cushy job all his life. When I say cushy job, I mean that he spent as much time on precinct captain work as he did actually in the pump station, because he could get away with that. On the other hand, so politics was permeated their home life. But there's another aspect to this.
Well, not only that, but it's the politics of cronyism, right?
The crony politics, exactly.
Right.
But he, as an African American precinct captain, was not treated as well as white precinct captains were in those days. We're talking about now in the 60s and 70s. And there was a sense of resentment that whereas white precinct captains in better neighborhoods, you know, more affluent neighborhoods, got better jobs and better paying jobs and rose higher and were paid off more lucratively, he... I think his name was Forrest Robinson, was not, because in his view it was because he was black.
And so that was kind of the seeds of her
she
racial,
had a
racially
chip,
based
a very
resentment.
Big chip on her shoulder about how politics in this country has been run, in her view, to the benefit of power white people, not the black people.
Which ties in beautifully to the whole theme of fair, social justice, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. So I think all along, we see this in her thesis in Princeton when she talks about, you know, how she felt like an outsider in Princeton. People didn't, you know, pay attention to her. I've interviewed people who were at Princeton with her at the time, And she and a lot of other African-American students during the time she was at Princeton ghettoized themselves. In other words,
they victimized themselves.
They stayed to themselves. They did not, mix it up with the white population. I believe me, I can tell you that being black in Princeton when she was there was not a negative. It was a positive. People would go out of their way to be nice to African-American students. But she didn't see it that way. And I think she's a bit, despite what she says about not being an angry person, I think she is quite angry. I think we've seen that when she said she was, for the first time in her life, she was proud of, to be an American when he
absolutely
won.
Absolutely. And listen, people can read her thesis online. You can listen to it in her own words. I mean, it's full of venom. It's absolutely venomous. And let's,
so she is, a political figure. She is a political creature. And her politics are exactly what you're saying. And that is, she wants to engineer social outcomes and engineer social justice, quote unquote. And that means redistributing wealth, taking it away from powerful white people and giving it to the minorities.
And redistributing wealth from the United States to poorer countries around the world.
Well, that's also part of her thing. I think it's even more so with him than it is with her.
Yes, I think
certainly with both of them, that's true.
Yeah, he's an avowed anti-colonialist, and America, in his mind, is a colonial power, along with Israel, the little colonial power.
Mm-hmm.
I want to spend just a minute or two, because there's a lot of things we need to cover. Carolyn Kennedy, what I'm trying to do for you folks who listen to the Democratic Convention, you heard all these great speeches. I think Ed is better suited to than just about anybody to tell you what's really going on behind all those pretty words and bright smiles in front of the cameras. So give us a minute on Carolyn Kennedy. And
okay,
what was she doing up there smiling and saying, let's elect Barack?
Well, Caroline and her uncle Teddy threw their arms around Barack Obama, as you recall, in 2008 and said he represented the tradition of John F. Kennedy. They laid hands upon him and transferred that glory to him. It was a very big deal. Teddy exacted a promise at that time, which was that Obama, if elected, would move heaven and earth to get a national health care bill passed. And Obama promised him that. Caroline didn't get any promises, but after he was elected, and she played a big role in campaigning for him, she sent him a long memo about private funding of public education, something that she had been engaged in with Mayor Bloomberg in New York City. That's what she did. She raised tons of money for public schools here in New York City. She never got a response. Then she tried to arrange a meeting on the yacht of Maurice Templesman, who was her late mother's longtime companion, who has a yacht up in Martha's Vineyard. And he's a big Democratic donor. Barack Obama refused to come. Then she tried to arrange a meeting between herself and Barack Obama at her home or his place at Martha's Vineyard while he was on vacation. Again, she was frozen out. Never received any response from the White House. Was invited to the White House one time only for the last 4 years.
So in view of that, you know, obviously dismissive behavior, what was she doing standing up there under the bright lights?
Well, after 3.5 years of ignoring her, they got in touch with her and said, you know, we would like you to say a few words for the president. And what the deal they struck was, I don't know. But I would assume that there was some kind of deal struck because they needed her more than she needed them. And she had the opportunity to represent the Kennedy family at the convention, in return for which I would assume that they were apologized and said that she could now have some influence on education policy, which is the area that she's most interested in. And she was there and gave a speech, but it was only after 3.5 years of total ignoring of her.
So the bottom line is the MO of these people is to use you when they need you, and then to discard you when they don't. When they've
done that with Oprah Winfrey, They did that with African-American business leaders who contributed from day one to Obama, and they dropped them. They've done it to Jewish-American donors who have raised tens and hundreds of millions of dollars for Obama and can't get their phone calls answered or ever get invited to the White House. So it's a pattern that is maybe one of the most obvious patterns in this White House, which is a lack of generosity, a lack of sense of any gratitude for help. It's as though we're entitled to it, you're giving it to us, and we don't owe you anything in return.
And when we come back, we're going to take another break here. When we come back, I want to take that MO against their closest allies in 2008 and previous. And I want to apply that to the middle class, because right now he needs middle class for what? Votes. And so I want to talk to you about that when we come back, Ed.
Okay.
We'll be back with you in just a moment, audience. Let's take a break.
400,000 readers have made the Threads West and American Saga series a number one bestseller in 2011 and 2012. Threads West and Maps of Fate are the first two books of a 16-book tale of the adventure and romance of America, her people, her spirit, and the West, winning 8 major national awards, including Best Western, Best Romance, and Best Historical Fiction. Author Reed Lance Rosenthal is a fourth-generation land and cattleman whose cowboy heart and poet's pen capture the spirit of the American landscape. His long-standing devotion to wild and remote places and to the people, both past and present, who leave their legend and footprint upon America and the American West, is the inspiration for all of his writing. Threads West, the first of the series, and Maps of Fate, Book 2, are available at all major bookstores, Hastings, Barnes & Noble, and on Amazon.com. Or go to ThreadsWestSeries.com. That's ThreadsWestSeries.com.
This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the right side, KGAB AM 650 Cheyenne in the Town Square Network, serving the Rocky Mountains of the United States, and KFEZ Colorado Springs. Hello, Colorado Springs, and WebTalkRadio.net. We have Ed Klein with the number one best-selling book, The Amateur, about your friend and mine, Barry Sotero, also known as Barack Hussein Obama, and unfortunately also the President of the United States. When we left for break, we were talking about the propensity of Obama and minions to cast aside people after they have used and abused them to achieve their end. And what I want to ask you, Ed, is would you consider, let's say middle class, let's say the name of the middle class is Tom, okay? Let's just call it the middle class Tom.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that right now Barack Obama desperately needs their votes to stay in power and accomplish his mission? In your case, you think his incompetency. In my case, I think his mission. And Tom, when he gets elected, because he has said nothing about what he has planned for the next 4 years, once he's elected, Tom, our friend the middle class, is going to get thrown out the window just like all his close associates have.
I do think that's going to happen, but I probably think it for a different reason than you do. I think that what will happen in a if Barack Obama is elected for a second 4-year term, and if, as I suspect, he will not have a majority in the House of Representatives and will not have a supermajority in the Senate, that there's still going to be gridlock in Washington. And what he will do, in fact, he's talked about this, I think he's going to go above the heads of the Congress, directly to the
He's going to go on an executive order binge. I mean, he's done 900
exactly.
of them. 901 of them since he's taken office. Folks, go back in the archives. I've done 3 shows on his executive orders about 2 months ago. You'll find them. It's in the title. And, Ed, I agree with you 100%.
Executive order binge, and then I couldn't agree more with that phraseology. And then he's going to go and have a constant, perpetual campaign, traveling around the country, riling up the people in favor of his executive orders. Now, this is not the democracy that the founding fathers had in mind. They had in mind...
Well, it's a frontal attack on the Constitution.
Absolutely. They had in mind a division of power among the three branches of government, and they specifically made sure that the president did not have kingly regal powers domestically. And here's a guy who is literally going to ignore all that, I believe. These are not just my suppositions. He's as much as said so.
Well, listen, in a 2001 PBS interview, when asked about his concept of the Constitution, I may have a word or two out of place, but folks can listen to it in the archives. I've talked about this. You can go Google it and listen to it for yourself. Barack Obama, PBS interview, 2001, Constitution. And his words were, the Constitution is merely a covenant of negative rights. That's what this guy thinks about the Constitution. This is the guy who stood in that long blue overcoat and on that cold, chilly January afternoon to adoring throngs and swore an oath to uphold it. Ed, let me ask a question. You and I are on the same track here. Give me three quick bullet points. What is the result to the middle class of what this guy intends to do in his second term?
Well, there's no question in my mind that he intends to do these executive orders in a way that will redistribute wealth. And up to now, people think that's only going to be from the very, very wealthy, meaning people who make $1 million or more a year. But but if you're in the middle class, that can mean anything from, what, $35,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. Household income to as much as 200,000 in your class, and small businesses, farmers, people who have saved are going to be hit hard with tax increases to pay for Obamacare, for instance. There are all kinds of hidden tax increases there. The country will not create enough jobs to absorb the new people coming into the employment force. Our position abroad is going to be weakened because he does not have the will or the desire to be a leader of the free world. And the country is going to go backwards, and the middle class is going to be the one that suffers the most.
That's right.
It's going to be a safety net for poor people. There'll always be a safety net for them. Really wealthy people will be able to take care of themselves. It's the middle class that's going to get screwed.
Remember, folks, and I say this over and over, over and over again, there are only two sources of revenue for a government, you and your property, period. That's all there is. I happen to agree with you, Ed. I think it'll be a dark day for the middle class. By the way, you were talking about taxes and Obamacare. Folks, go back in the archives. I've done two shows on that, 21 taxes, $675 billion, and guess whose pocket it comes out of? It ain't the rich folks, and it sure as hell isn't Barack Obama because he's exempt from it. I want to move to the next subject, which is international. Ed, you know, there is a tempest going over right now with Iran close to the nuclear bomb and, the obvious discord between Israel and the United States, really for the first time since Truman recognized the state of Israel. Tell me what you think his policy, what you think his intentions are there, and what is driving those intentions?
He believes, and I've reported on this in the Amateur.
Yeah, you had a great section on it.
That it is Israel who is standing in the way of his policies in the Middle East and maybe even beyond the Middle East. That if Israel would just stop its
existing.
He wouldn't say that, but
that's what he thinks.
Well, if it wasn't for Israel, he's indicated that we wouldn't be having all these wars in the Middle East, things would be hunky-dory, that everybody would get along with each other, and that he could then create a coalition of Arab states and Palestinians to blunt the Iranian rise to hegemony in that area of the world. And he blames it all on Israel because he thinks that Israel is standing in the way. If it weren't for Israel, the lions would lay down with the lambs and that kind of crap.
Don't you think his whole theory, you know, he's kind of set in so many words, you know, the United States of Islam over there. I mean, if he views us as a colonial power, right, we're way too big for our britches. We're the 1% of the world, and then, of course, you have the 1% within the 1%, which is the rich people here in the United States. That United States of Islam, okay, Israel, the little colonial power, or as the president of Iran would call it, the little Satan, we being the big Satan, Israel is almost single-handedly standing in the way of equalizing, of social justice for the Mideast. What do you think about that?
I think that's another one of the reasons I call him the amateur, because I think his view of the Middle East is an amateur's view. It's absolutely based on nothing, on BS. He doesn't understand the history of the place. He doesn't understand the fact that the Israelis have this right to the land, that the Israelis have offered almost everything possible to the Palestinians to make a two-state solution, that in fact, and that Iran, for all its saber rattling against Israel, that Israel is, you know, a convenient scapegoat for Iran. Iran wants hegemony in the entire Middle East.
That's
not just Israel.
A caliphate.
Yes, it wants to recreate the caliphate and control everything from Iran all the way through North Africa, including Saudi Arabia and the oil and Egypt and Libya and Morocco and you name it. And this is, Iran has this great Persian dream of reestablishing a Persian empire.
And Israel stands in the way.
Israel is the only thing that really stands in the way at this point.
And listen, the teachings of Reverend Wright, okay, because this kind of leads us right into it. I mean, his bleedings up there on the pulpit that Barack and Michelle did not listen to. They didn't listen to the guy who baptized their children, who he called a mentor in his book. They didn't listen to him. But his bleedings included rants against Israel. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, big time.
I
make a point in my book saying that it's less important that Barack Obama sat in the pew in that church, the Trinity United Church of Christ, and listened to those poisonous sermons, than the fact that he met personally outside the church in the parsonage of the church with the Reverend Wright, not a few times, not 20 or 30 times, but literally hundreds of times, one-on-one, just the two of them, talking about his career, talking about his politics, talking about policies, talking about whether he should run for this office or that office and how he should do it. He went to the Reverend Wright for everything, including being indoctrinated into the Reverend Wright's Black liberation theology theories of there being an oppressor class whites and an oppressed class blacks, and the only way to smooth this out was to redistribute the wealth and the power in this country and make sure that it was more fairly distributed.
And that's
Marxism 101.
Absolutely. And between other countries. You know, in the Reverend Wright interview that you did, I was really struck by what Reverend Wright said Obama told him. They had a secret meeting, which you do a beautiful job of capsulizing in the book, in your interview. And your interviews, your excerpts from the interview are fascinating. Because, by the way, folks, the MO we were talking about, use people, throw them under the bus, you know, Tom the middle class. I mean, here's Reverend Wright, really his best friend, and he threw him under the bus in 2008. You don't think he's going to not throw you, Mr. White, middle-class guy? You don't think he's going to throw you under the bus? Oh, my. Anyway, what was that last line, Ed, that Obama said to Wright as he left that secret meeting when he told Wright, don't be public before the election anymore?
Yeah, please shut up. Don't talk. You're hurting me.
Exactly.
And the Reverend Wright said, no, I cannot stop speaking because I have principles. And Barack Obama said to him, you know what the trouble with you is, Rev? He called him Rev. And the Reverend Wright said, no, what's my trouble? The trouble with you, Rev, is you've got to tell the truth. And the Reverend Wright turned to him and said, well, you know, for that's not such a bad problem for a minister to have. Maybe you should have the same problem, too.
Yeah, I want people to think about the words of Barack Obama. You have to tell the truth. The unspoken words are, I don't. I'm going to have you back on because I want to talk more about Reverend Wright because I think that's a huge shaping influence in Obama's past. But in terms of the anti-Israeli policy, which I think is clear to anybody, I mean, this God in, Jerusalem in, out of the Democratic Convention, half of this now progressive party voting no to put it back in. I mean, all you got to do is listen to your ears. But in his National Security Council, he now has anti-Israeli, pro-Palestinian council, correct? Samantha Powers being one of them.
Samantha Powers being the most powerful figure in that group. Yes, yeah, she's in the National Security Council, and she's a very anti-Israeli, very pro-Palestinian figure, and has a tremendous influence with the president.
Yeah, so folks, I want you to think about this, you know, think about his background. Think about his actions. Forget his words. His actions relative to Israel right now, particularly with them under imminent threat of annihilation, as voiced repeatedly by Iran. And think about who he's appointed as counsel, and think about who he listens to for advice, and then ask yourself, is he a friend of Israel? I'll let you answer the question, audience. Ed, I want to finish up with you. We've got a few minutes left. You are of the opinion that he is incompetent. You know, he's an amateur.
He's an amateur, in my view, in terms of executive governance, yes.
Right. And my opinion is that he is brilliant with a plan, that he is beautifully executing right under everybody's noses while he leads them astray. Correlate those two things for me. You said something early in the interview, which I thought was really perfect. He's an amateur with a dark side. And, you know, somewhere in your book, I forget exactly where it was, you were talking to somebody, and they talked about how hard it was for them to conceal his dark side. Correlate those two. I mean, we're agreed on what he's doing. We're agreed on where he's going. We're agreed on the absolutely disastrous effects to the country, the middle class, American values, you name it. But equate why you think he's incompetent, whether it's a governance or anything else, when he's been able to accomplish so much of what his obvious left-wing social justice, downtrod the 1% in the U.S., downtrod the U.S. as the 1% of the world. Explain that to me.
Well, I think the best way to explain it to you is to think about Ronald Reagan, 1981-82. He has a Democratic House of Representatives with a Democratic Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill. And at the end of the day, he picks up the phone. This has, you know, been reported. He calls Tip O'Neill. He says, hey, Tip, why don't you come on over to the White House and have a drink with me? And this happened not once or twice, but many, many times. Tip O'Neill, shrewd Irish Boston politician, far, you know, real liberal, goes over to the White House and sits down opposite a conservative president of the United States. They open a bottle of bourbon. They have a drink. They tell jokes. They reminisce. They have a good laugh. They talk about people they know in common, and they gossip. And after they've broken the ice and had a pretty good time for whatever, 15, 20 minutes, the president turns to Tip O'Neill, with whom he has absolutely nothing in common politically. And he says, you know, Tip, I need to get that bill, whatever bill he's talking about, passed in the House. What do I need to do to get it passed? And O'Neill says, well, you know, Mr. President, I can't get my boys to vote for it as it now stands because it has X, Y, Z in it. And Reagan says, well, I can't take it all out, but I'll take some of it out. And they come to an agreement, and that's something
and the
that Barack
bill
Obama
passed.
Cannot do.
But here's where you and I differ. We're going to take this up, if you're agreeable, on our next interview sometime before the election. I don't think he wants the bill passed. See, you're coming from the assumption that kind of the normalcy bias. He would like to get something passed. I don't think he wants anything passed. He does not want anything to work. I'm going to let the viewers, after my interviews of the last few weeks and this terrific interview with Ed, kind of sort that out for themselves. Ed, I would love to have you back on.
Absolutely.
It's been a terrific interview. And I want to thank you very much for taking your time to I hope, help a lot of people make decisions. And once again, folks, read The Amateur. Get your friends to read The Amateur, and particularly get anybody and everybody you know in a swing state to read The Amateur. Ed, have a great day.
Thanks so much.
For more information about Reed and his work, please go to webtalkradio.net and look for Reed Lance Rosenthal on the right side. There, you can also click to purchase the first two volumes of his number one best-selling historical Western series, Threads West, An American Saga, and Maps of Fate. And now, the first volume of his new nonfiction series, Land for Love and Money, is available everywhere. Or go to landforloveandmoney.com. That's Land for Love and Money. We'd also like to remind you that if you missed any shows, you can go to the show archives on Reed's WebTalkRadio.net page. We look forward to seeing you again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.